Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
A very important book has just come my way. I've been reading it with utter fascination. It is titled Haunting Legacy, Vietnam and the American Presidency from Ford to Obama. The authors are father and daughter, Marvin Kalb and Deborah Kalb. Marvin Kalb was for many years a leading figure at the Kennedy School at Harvard University, where, among other things, he established and ran the Shorenstein Center. What is it fully called?
Shorenstein Center on Press, Politics, and Public Policy.
How about that? And having learned a great deal about press, politics, and public policy from her father, Deborah Kalb went on to be a very active journalist around Washington. And now the two of you have done this book, Haunting Legacy. I offer you, it's classy to start with a good epigraph, Shakespearean or Homeric, if possible. The best I can offer tonight is from George Bernard Shaw, who says, "We learn from history that we learn nothing from history." And you are saying that our presidents have all of them been somewhat preoccupied with North Vietnam, with the Vietnam War, and with our defeat in the Vietnam War, and they have felt their foreign policies, and particularly on the military side of foreign policy, have been somehow reactive one way or another to the Vietnam defeat.
Well, they absolutely have been, Milt. But let me first say what a pleasure it is for me to be back here with you. I have a feeling it's about 25 years since we have sat opposite each other with two fat microphones in our faces.
It was a long time ago.
Delighted
to have you here.
And I'm happy to be back with Debbie to meet you.
You could have brought her 25 years ago.
I would have been delighted to, absolutely delighted to. But the answer to your question is, it's an important question, and the Vietnam experience was as powerful and remains as powerful as it is because Vietnam is the only war that the United States lost. When a great power loses a war to a country like North Vietnam, which Lyndon Johnson described as a raggedy-ass little fourth-rate country, when a great power loses to that, it has to ask itself a lot of very important questions. One of the most important is, how do I avoid that mess once again? And every single one of our presidents has been absorbed with that question.
Let us hear us losing that war. I have two brief sound clips from a reporter for the Independent Television News. This goes back to April 29th, 1971.
75.
70.
Am I wrong?
Five, of course.
Yeah.
My producer's written this incorrectly. April 29th, 1975, which is the day before we abandoned the embassy, and that
exactly.
is the ultimate end of the war. And here are those two sound clips in a row.
For one moment, they panicked, and rightly so. The mortar hit right in the middle of them down on the right, 100 yards away. It's killed a lot of people. But now they've gone back to some of their positions. They've left one wounded in the road. Let's see the wounded. Got this, and dead on the right.
They held the bridge a few more hours, but everyone knew this was the end. Saigon was about to fall. Soon the war would be over. As they pulled back, they brought with them a wounded Viet Cong, a young woman commando they had been fighting. Now the enemy, soon the victor. American embassy officials had promised an orderly evacuation for their own people, the foreign press, and for all those Vietnamese who had worked for them and might be in danger. The plan was for a helicopter evacuation from the embassy grounds, and the signal was Bing Crosby singing White Christmas over Radio Saigon. But somebody forgot to play it, and the embassy was stormed. So people fought and clawed their way over that wall, and they did fight and they did claw. The hysteria was infectious.
This is a historic moment, the arrival of the North Vietnamese regular army in Saigon, right in the middle of Saigon, just after 12 o'clock, just after noon. Here they are pouring down the main avenue. Further up there is the American embassy. At this end of the avenue is the former presidential palace, which President Chu left just over a week ago, and from which General Min has today announced that he will unconditionally hand over to the new regime.
Their tanks had thundered down the length of Vietnam all the way from Hanoi. Now they crossed Saigon's boulevards, and their foot-weary infantry plodded past the deserted military barracks. The people did not know whether they should cheer or weep, and they had yet to discover who was friend and who was foe. They had expected a bloodbath, but not a shot was fired that day, and not a drop of blood spilt. The communist flag flew over a Saigon renamed, to honor the man whose prophecies had led them here and who had died before he saw them come true. They called it Ho Chi Minh City. South Vietnam, such a short-lived nation, was finally toppled.
Well, that does convey it. In British accent, no less.
Yes.
So there may be a touch of condescension at the trouble that the Yanks are in.
Well, the marvelous thing about that, Milt, is that even at the very end, the U.S. was still surprised that it was going to end that way, because it was very difficult for us to accept the fact that we were being beaten by this raggedy-ass little fourth-rate country. The troops that were described by the British reporter were North Vietnamese regular army troops. They were not Viet Cong guerrillas. And what happened was that those people came on down in huge number. The South Vietnamese army couldn't support a logical and sustained opposition to their attacks. They fell back. The Americans had practically no troops left there. The only thing that was there to do was to surrender.
Now, Deborah, you and Marvin have been interviewing literally hundreds of people over a period of 5 or more years in preparation of and then the writing of this book. What do we know about the then sitting American president, about Gerry Ford, and how he took this defeat and what it did to the remainder of his rather fragile presidency?
That's an excellent question. We actually have 2 chapters in Haunting Legacy about President Ford. We have the chapter that really deals with what the reporter was describing in that clip that you just played, which was the reaction to the end of the war. And as my father mentioned, the United States was surprised. This was happening. I mean, this was a superpower. This was a superpower being defeated by such a smaller country. And we deal with really how the administration handled that, what was going on behind the scenes, and how they dealt with the reporters who were covering it as well. And that is part of the issue, too. I mean, you had President Ford's press secretary, Ron Nessen, who was interviewed for this book, talking about what was going on behind the scenes, these sort of frantic meetings, both at the end of the war and also in the second chapter on President Ford that we have about the incident several weeks after the fall of Saigon dealing with the Mayaguez.
Yes, the Cambodian pirates gave him an opportunity to show some manliness in the face of our recent defeat. Explain that.
Yeah, exactly. This was only a few weeks after the U.S. had been defeated. And here we were again dealing with an incident in Southeast Asia. And this was a U.S. merchant ship, the Mayaguez, which was off the coast of Cambodia and was intercepted by Cambodian pirates. And the U.S. did not want to appear weak, a so-called paper tiger, in the wake of this very recent, very difficult defeat. And so Ford decided to really go in strong with the kind of force that perhaps was not necessary for this relatively small incident. But of course, having just suffered through the defeat of Vietnam, the U.S. didn't want to be perceived as once again not being able to measure up to a foe that was not as powerful.
The defeat is it's also curious. We have evidence now that Johnson was convinced we could not win that war, and that McNamara only later, and he did this on a tour of a last book of his. Indeed, I talked to him on that book. Now realize that we were all wrong. We couldn't have won that war. We should not have been there. Whether Michael Beschloss's tapes, or as he's pulled them together, yep. of Johnson's private yep. conversations. There's one conversation where Johnson is talking, I think, to Senator Richard Russell.
Richard Russell.
And
very
he's
famous.
Saying, if it's very famous, repeat the content.
Well, I can't. I can do the content. I can't do yeah. it word for
no,
word because
not.
There were two Southern politicians, and I'm not good at that. Richard Russell was saying to Johnson, are we going to be able to win this thing? I mean, what's the point? And Johnson was saying, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to win this. I'm really not sure. And Russell said, if you're not sure, let's get the hell out of there.
Yes.
And he said, I can't do that. I cannot be a president who lost a war. So we've got to see this through. And they both kind of commiserated with each other that the United States of America had to see through something that both acknowledged probably could not
be won. Some military guys later on said we could have won that war if we had played it differently. Do either of you agree?
Well, I would say flat out. Deb, you go first.
Well, personally, I think it would have been very difficult to win the war given the situation. With the so-called hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people, I think that it would have been a very tough situation to try to win over in the face of a guerrilla opponent. But I
and hearts and minds might be the key rather than mere military power.
Yes. I mean, that's a big part of it, but you should go
ahead. My sense is that it would not have been possible to win the war. First of all, we had never been involved in a war like that. We didn't know anything really about the Vietnamese people, their religion, their culture, none of that. And it didn't make any difference to us. We saw the Vietnam War as part of a larger Cold War in which the United States was fighting really not the North Vietnamese. We were thinking they're simply proxies. They're in there because otherwise the Chinese would come in or the Russians. So we never believed that we could lose that war. It never entered our minds.
What was the name of Kennedy's assistant?
Kenny O'Donnell.
Kenny O'Donnell said to me years ago, when I was just starting to do this program, and he said it in a book that he and that other
That's
guy
right.
wrote, Johnny, we hardly
right.
knew you, was the title of the book. He said President Kennedy was dedicated to pulling out of Vietnam right after he won the 1964 election.
I don't believe
that for
an instant. Lots of people
have faulted Kenny O'Donnell and said that wasn't true.
I don't believe that for an instant. John F. Kennedy was, I mean, go back to the first speech he made as president of the United States. We will accept any burden, do this and that. He was a tough anti-communist. He was not going to be there and watch a country go down to communism. We have to remember that we're talking now about a period in the early 1960s, 13 years before China went communist, and that created a political scandal.
Well, so much for Gerry Ford. We're going to look at the various presidents and the military operations that they either got into or resisted getting
right.
into, and why, and how Vietnam did indeed haunt their thought and haunted their plans. Thus, the title of your book, Haunting Legacy. As we come now to that man of great firmness, resolve, and dedication, Jimmy Carter. We'll be right with him after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we go directly back to Marvin Kalb and Deborah Kalb, drawing from their most interesting book and highly informative, Haunting Legacy, Vietnam and the American Presidency from Ford to Obama. And we've run through the presidents. That's as good a structure as any for us to follow tonight.
Sure.
So we come to Jimmy Carter, and his military occasions or opportunities were variable, but certainly the one that sticks most in memory is the hostage crisis.
Of course.
In Tehran. Could he have handled that, do you think, Deborah, any differently? Should he have?
Well, he certainly could have. I mean, Jimmy Carter came into office in the wake of Watergate and Vietnam, And he really wanted to have a totally different kind of presidency, a bloodless presidency. He was a very religious man, and he really did not want to revisit the images of casualties.
So he was preoccupied by our loss in Vietnam.
Oh, yes, he was. And I think that he, when the hostage situation came up, he really did not want to see casualties coming out of that. And, you know, some of his advisors would say, we need to do more, we need to do more. Now, eventually, he did authorize the hostage rescue effort, which unfortunately was a huge failure.
It was puny and pitiful,
yeah,
in a way.
It was a failure. And really, which was unfortunate. And he was very shattered by the failure of that and by the fact that there were casualties in that
effort. He was also on his knees, in a way, during that whole 444 days. Wasn't that the
very
length?
Much so. He was.
So that he looked kind of ridiculous to the country.
Well, he did, in a way, look. I think that may be a bit harsh because everyone in this country suffered when the hostages were taken and when they were made such an awful display of them and all of that. But Jimmy Carter, at the very beginning, to speak kindly of the man, at the very beginning, Jimmy Carter did some truly wonderful things in foreign affairs. He was the one who got the Camp David agreement between Israel and Egypt, which was an extraordinary piece of work. He was the one who got the Panama Canal done. Extraordinary piece of work. He was the one who solidified the opening to China. Big deal. He also got the START 1 treaty with the Russians. So he did a lot of things which make two events all the more shattering to him. One, which Debbie has just discussed, on the business about the hostage crisis and the failure to do anything right on that. That was a disaster, a disgrace. The second thing was the Russians moving into Afghanistan. That was the ultimate, and that got Carter angry.
And his first response was to take us out of the Olympics, which were scheduled for Moscow.
Exactly. Well, he was looking to do something, and he didn't quite know what to do. At that point, entered Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yeah.
Now, let me tell you an interesting story about Zbig. Zbigniew Brzezinski is a very bright guy, and he is a genuine Polish-American nationalist, which meant in the context of 1979 that anything we could do against the Soviet Union was a good thing, not just for Poland, but for the United States and the Western world. So Zbig came up with this plan. It was at the beginning a secret plan, and to a large extent it remains that if we could get China, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United States together in a secret alliance against the Soviet Union and its troops in Afghanistan, we could then arm the Mujahideen, these Islamic fanatic fighters in Afghanistan, the same fighters we're fighting today in Afghanistan,
sure,
we created, And Brzezinski set up the secret.
And the same fighters who staffed the original al-Qaeda.
Absolutely.
Including Osama bin Laden.
Absolutely. And what happened at that time was that we were the guys behind the secret war against the Russians in Afghanistan. And in the back of Brzezinski's mind, and he was right, in the back of his mind was this thought. If we could humiliate the Russians and give them, quote, their Vietnam, then what we could do more than likely is topple the communist system in the Soviet Union. And that, to him, was his ultimate goal.
Well, now, it is true that Afghanistan did turn out to, excuse me, to be the Soviet Vietnam.
It absolutely.
They finally exited with their tails between their legs.
Yeah, and my point here, Milt, is that Brzezinski was absolutely right in the way in which he sort of saw the world evolve.
Are you suggesting that without the Afghan defeat, the Soviet Union would still be there?
I could imagine that the Soviet Union would be there for a period of time. But I think what happened in Afghanistan, the fact that the troops went back loaded with drugs, I mean, it was a terrible. It was not only the collapse of Soviet power. What did that mean? It meant the Red Army had collapsed.
It was the collapse of Soviet military morale.
Military morale, military might, and then the communist system itself disintegrated. To Brzezinski, that was the ultimate triumph. So later on, when people would say to him, gee whiz, Spig, you are the one who started all of the Mujahideen we're fighting right now, he would say, which is the greater triumph? I mean, put it on a scale of values, he would say, defeating the Soviet Union or fighting another war against Islamic fanatics.
Well, do I get the hint then that he has persuaded you that he was right?
Well, he has persuaded me that he came up with a very interesting concept, which he persuaded the president of the United States, more important, the president of the United States to pursue this. And the president did pursue it. And within a matter of 7 or 8 years after that, in the at the very beginning of the Bush 1 administration, Afghanistan and the Russians were forced to pull out of Afghanistan. They had their Vietnam. Brzezinski was vindicated, and that gave Carter the only bit of pleasure he got as he retreated to Plains, Georgia, a very, very despondent guy.
Well, he hasn't been despondent for the rest of his life. He's been a very active ex-president.
Oh, he's been an active ex-president because he couldn't be an effective president.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
We are about to pause for an update on the news. And then we come to the next president in line. I think we're just going to go down the line. And for all of their regimes, we'll look not at economic policy, not at domestic issues so much as the foreign crises that they had to handle and whether they did or didn't take a recourse to some military options. And if so, did they do it effectively or did they, in fact, back off with some hesitation because they still had Vietnam on their minds? We return directly to Deborah Kalb and Marvin Kalb as we draw from their new book, Haunting Legacy. But right now, to the WGN newsroom. And I'm not sure who's there tonight, but we'll find out. Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And directly back to the Kalbs, Marvin Kalb and Deborah Kalb, his daughter, the co-authors of the book, Haunting Legacy, Vietnam, and the American Presidency from Ford to Obama. The publishers are Brookings Institution
Brookings,
Press.
Right.
So they must have had a hand in sponsoring this book as well.
Well, they absolutely, not only in publishing it, but in promoting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the book is a major contribution. I trust that future presidents will be reading it.
I certainly hope so. Yeah. I certainly hope so.
I hope the present president will.
Well, Debbie and I were thinking about that this afternoon, try to find a way of getting a copy through to him.
We will come to him and his war policies.
Yes,
and his war engagements before we're finished tonight. But we come now in sequential order to Ronald Reagan, whom it is generally assumed was a much tougher guy than was Carter. But
right.
In fact, if you look at the record, Deborah, he pulled away from some crucial engagements, didn't he?
Yes. No, that's very well put. You think of President Reagan as a very hawkish, very tough president on foreign policy. And yet you look back to a weekend in October 1983, which was about 28 years ago now, when he was faced with two crises in one weekend with the invasion of Grenada, a request from some Caribbean countries to invade, for the U.S. to invade Grenada, to knock out a Marxist leadership there, and also the news of 241 U.S. Marines being killed in their barracks by a terrorist bombing in Beirut, Lebanon.
So that was a horrible scene.
It was horrible. And
killed in their sleep, as a matter of fact.
Yes, yes. And President Reagan opted to not retaliate for this bombing in Lebanon. And in fact, several months later, pulled the Marine contingent out of Lebanon completely, which is surprising when you think of the image of Reagan. Now, at the same time, there was the invasion of Grenada, which was presented by some in the administration as the U.S. is back after Vietnam.
Yeah, but that was virtually a cakewalk.
Exactly. That was a very, very minor engagement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yet,
well, why didn't he do it, Milt? I got to pick this point up.
Please.
The reason he didn't take action was Vietnam. And he said in a letter that he wrote, I mean, one of the wonderful things for us about doing this book was the opportunity once again to study our presidents and to gain a new appreciation of the complexity of being a president of the United States, particularly after Vietnam, when there's an issue of sending troops abroad to fight and possibly die. Reagan said, in one of these wonderful letters, he wrote longhand to people, hundreds of these letters, and in his diary, he said the American people were spooked his verb, by Vietnam. And I simply do not want to put them through this experience again. So in his mind, in the Lebanon debacle, was Vietnam and the fear he had that if he sent troops in, if he retaliated fully, which meant boots on the ground, not mm-hmm. just from the air, he would possibly spook the American people again. He didn't want to do it.
But on the other hand, one would have to ask, what did that convey to all of our potential enemies in the Middle East?
Well, I think what, not only what I think, Bud McFarlane, who was his national security advisor, was very explicit. He told the president, if you do not take action, and we got to make one other point. Bud McFarlane, his national security advisor, was an ex-Marine. The Secretary of State, George Shultz, was an ex-Marine. These two ex-Marines exhorted the president, pleaded with the president, retaliate, because if you don't, it will appear to the bad guys who did this that they can take action with impunity against the United States of America. In fact, when the Iranian hostage crisis came, and when all sorts of things developed in that part of the world, somebody like Nasrallah, who is
the head of
the leader of
Hezbollah,
right,
now, yeah.
right? Yes, somebody like Nasrallah could tell his people, "You can't trust the United States of America. They're nothing." You know, in other words, you can do anything to the U.S. and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that Reagan chose not to take action, because he didn't want to spook the American people again because of Vietnam, left a bad legacy.
You know, going to the other side of the world in a somewhat different historical period, I'm not sure who was the president at the time, that Mao Tse-tung characterized the United States as a paper tiger.
Right. Well, Richard Nixon was fearful that the United States would be perceived as a paper tiger
yeah.
if we lost in Vietnam. Well, we ended up losing. Gerald Ford did what Debbie was talking about before with the Mayaguez, out of fear that we would be perceived to be a paper tiger.
There's another interesting Reagan misadventure. It involves a cake, and it involves supplies to Iran.
To Iran, indeed. And this was the kind of thing that Reagan
and
really—
And Bud McFarlane was involved
in
that.
It was McFarlane, indeed, and he was the one who went there, as a matter of fact.
Carrying the cake. Yes.
Carrying a cake. And what's interesting to me about that was McFarlane is a very— tough-minded.
Well, shortly after that, he attempted suicide, as I remember.
He did. He did, because he did something that he regarded as so bad that as a, he's a marvelous patriot, this yeah. man. You can't knock the guy. And
Marine.
A Marine.
Yeah.
And what he felt he had embarrassed, humiliated the United States, and he made an effort to kill himself. He is now, I am happy to say, back working very, very hard, doing wonderful things in Africa. But he is, in effect, no longer in power.
But if we deal with Reagan and whether he was tough where he needed to be tough, he was, of course, tough on another front, and that was vis-a-vis the Soviet Union.
Well, he was tough in the sense that when he was running for office in 84, he realized that to win and win big, he had to come through as a peacenik, as opposed to a hardline warrior. Because in 81, 82, 83, he was building up the military nonstop. And he was projecting the image of huge military strength.
And he was placing missiles in Europe.
In, absolutely, in Central Europe. And that also, is what makes, but that is what makes the Marine episode in Beirut so hideous.
Yeah,
I mean, you're doing all of this stuff all over the world, but here are 241 of your people who were killed and you don't do anything. And that is where Vietnam had a totally inhibiting
intimations
effect.
Of something to come later on.
Yes.
Black Hawk Down.
Yes.
Another president.
Yes, another president.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton.
And we'll go on with this examination of our presidents and how they have handled well or handled poorly some of the challenges in the world, particularly challenges that require some sort of military response. We will return directly after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I don't want to leave Reagan yet as we return to the Kalbs, Deborah and Marvin. Margaret Thatcher has said she on this program one night, she said it was a very, very memorable moment. She said that it was essentially Ron Reagan, as she always called him, who brought the Soviet Union down, and he did it. The final blow, the final nail in the coffin, was his plan for whatever we called it in those days, the space initiative.
Star Wars.
Star Wars, exactly. I was trying to remember what the technical title of it was. Yeah. Do you remember?
Strategic Defense Initiative.
There we are. Like Strategic that. Defense Initiative. And that presented Gorbachev with a challenge which he could not match. It would have been far too expensive, and it sort of exhausted and disordered the Soviet economy and everything else, and it softened them up for the ultimate breakdown. I think that's far too simple a view, maybe even a touch mythological. But what do you make of it?
Well, I think that's certainly one part of it. I mean, Reagan's policy certainly had an impact on the Soviet Union, but also look back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with Afghanistan during the Carter period, with Brzezinski's efforts to suck the Soviet army deeper in there and the morale problems that that army had as a result of that. And that was also a contributing factor. So there are many factors involved in what brought down the Soviet Union. But one interesting thing about the book in general is that, yes, the Vietnam War was over, but for the first several presidents that we look at, the Cold War was still going on, and it did play a role in terms of how each of those first three presidents we look at were dealing with these conflicts, because they always did have the Cold War as a backdrop to consider.
And as the Cold War came to an end, we had some in the academic world, and I suppose in the security intellectual realm generally, who saw a new time of peace was now going to be available. The ultimate expression of that was from Francis Fukuyama.
Yeah, in his
book,
End of History.
Titled The End of History.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's madness afloat all over the place.
To be sure.
And one of the great madnesses was to believe that when the Soviet Union went down, we were truly entering a period of peace, that all would be well. What we did not understand was, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it simply, as Kissinger said the other day in Washington, by the way, he said, all of these problems, whenever you think you've solved something, you've simply opened the door to a whole rush of other problems that come in. We did not really appreciate for about 15 years the full implications of the collapse of the Soviet Union and what it would mean.
As a matter of fact, only a few years after Fukuyama's volume, a far more significant and valuable work was done by Sam Huntington at Harvard.
That's right.
You probably knew Sam.
Yes, I did very well.
Just a few years ago, in which he predicted the clash of civilizations.
Absolutely.
And he saw two great civilizational confrontations that we would ultimately face in history. One was with China, and the other was with Islam.
The Islamic world.
The Islamic world.
Yeah, well, Sam Huntington, I think, hit it right in the head.
I do, too.
And I think that we're living with the consequences of that right now. At the very beginning of the Reagan chapter, we write there something that I'm particularly proud of, so let me say it. And that was, for people who studied Reagan at the time, they vastly exaggerated his role in the collapse of the Soviet Union. And as you were pointing out Margaret Thatcher a little bit ago, Margaret Thatcher was a very smart lady, but she really was not a student of the Soviet Union. Had she been a student, she would have appreciated the fact that the economy of the Soviet Union was in utter disarray and near total collapse. And the communist system was filled with cynicism and corruption. It was simply waiting to fall apart. It needed only somebody to push it.
Curiously, with regard to the making of war, she gave a real exemplification of a profile in courage and a totally different part of the world and a sort of a totally different war. The Argentines grabbed some British islands just off the southeast coast of South America, the Falklands.
That's right.
And she mobilized the British Navy and the British Marine Force and fought a war down there.
Well, if fought a war down there, she didn't have Vietnam to worry about.
Yeah.
She did not have Vietnam to worry about. And that was probably the last major British military operation. And I think in history, it will probably go down as the last major British military operation. What the Brits did in Libya more recently is, depending on your point of view, admirable or not, but the Brits did a couple of big-time military things, but not the way the Falklands.
It redeemed them of something that had gone wrong some years before. Anthony Eden over Suez.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed.
So they had their own problems in this regard. We come then to the next president in line, the vice president, to Ronald Reagan, who becomes president. George, is it W.H. or H.W.?
H.W.
H.W. Bush. He had a lot on his plate as well. Of course, shortly after, how soon after he came to office did Saddam Hussein invade Kuwait?
What happened was that he came into office, of course, in January of 1989.
Yeah.
Kuwait was invaded in June or July of 1990.
There you are, yeah.
So it was a year and a half later. But when that invasion took place, Bush at the beginning was loath to get involved because Vietnam was all over him and he didn't want to take an action that he could not control.
Then what's the inside dope on that? Who advised him or nudged him in that direction?
Well, I think what happened was that the extraordinary series of events, actually. Number one, Jim Baker, Secretary of State, mm-hmm. went to the Soviet Union, went to Russia, really. It was the Soviet Union then, and the tail end of the Soviet Union, and persuaded them to become kind of in union with the United States against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. That was a big deal. It was a real big deal. But the United States was operating then still very much in the darkest shadows of Vietnam. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, came up with what came to be called the Powell Doctrine. The Powell Doctrine was born out of the Vietnam experience. Rather than in Vietnam have no real strategy, not know exactly what you're going to do, according to Powell, if you're going to commit American forces, they have to have a clear-cut objective. You have to know what you're doing.
And they have to have massive, massive force.
Massive force.
Yeah.
You go in when you want to go in, and you get out according to a prearranged exit strategy. Mm-hmm. You have congressional support. You have popular support. And when you go in to win. None of this Vietnam stuff where year after year you don't know what the heck you're doing there. You want to commit American force. And I think, frankly, my editorial opinion here, I think that the United States, if it goes to war, if it's going to commit young people to fight and possibly to die, you have to know what is your objective and you have to achieve that objective. You can't play games anymore.
Well, it was an easier situation than, say, the present Afghanistan situation. Saddam Hussein had sent his army in to take one particular area of Kuwait directly bordering Iran.
And, Iraq. Bordering Iraq.
Bordering Iraq, rather. He could have been pushed out with massive force. The task was simply essentially to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait.
Yes, and this is again where Vietnam comes into play in a massive way. Saddam Hussein could have simply been kicked out of Iraq, of Kuwait. That was easy to do. Colin Powell had 540,000 men in the Persian Gulf. It's a huge army. In order to take care of a couple of divisions of the Iraqis, weren't well trained in any case. The real issue came up. Should we now go on to Baghdad
exactly.
and get rid of Saddam Hussein?
What was the name of his general?
Schwarzkopf.
Schwarzkopf on the
right.
On the ground.
Right. Now, but what happened at that time was that Brent Scowcroft, who was President Bush's national security advisor, Scowcroft recommended very, very strongly, don't go to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we would get ourselves into Baghdad, and it'll be the same situation that we had in Saigon in 1975. Who is going to run the country after we get rid of Saddam Hussein?
But they gave him so much continued control of his own military, particularly of his helicopter force, that he, Saddam Hussein, was able then to work a kind of a partial genocide upon arrested portions of his own population, particularly the Shiite marsh Arabs in the south and the Kurds in the north.
You're absolutely right, and that was one of the things that people like Brent Scowcroft to this day suffer.
I would hope he should.
Guilt complex, yeah, because of that.
tens of thousands, maybe 100,000.
Well, we don't know exactly how many, but a lot of people
were killed by the Iraqi government.
And the U.S. government and President Bush himself gave reason to believe that we would protect them. And we did not.
Yes. Exactly
we did not so. Because we didn't want to get involved in Iraq. That was the essential point of that.
What other military challenges, if any, occurred during the one administration of the first President Bush?
Well, getting back just to one other point that came out of the Iraq episode was that President Bush said when it was ending, we have buried the ghost of Vietnam in the Saints of Arabia.
Yes, he got off that famous line, didn't he?
And that was something that didn't happen because then his son went back into Iraq and really was faced with that same dilemma.
I remember one afternoon in this very building, after that war ended, suddenly there was a great victory parade right down Michigan Avenue.
Really?
As there had been in New York a day or two before, perhaps. And there were literally thousands of troops supposedly returned from the Middle East.
Right.
Maybe some were from more local locations, but they were in battle gear, so to speak.
And there's a wonderful story about that, Milt, that Colin Powell was called up to New York to watch that same kind of parade there. Colin Powell did not have tears in his eyes, but almost did when he watched these guys because he remembered the troops coming back from the Vietnam War.
From Vietnam, yeah.
And it was so awful at that time. And yet, here were troops coming back from a victorious operation. That was the reason that if you didn't go to Baghdad, and you kept it to that limited objective, consistent with the Powell Doctrine.
You could call that a victory.
You could call that a victory, yeah. Exactly.
But, you know, in the old doggerel, 'twas a famous victory, said Tweedledum to Tweedledee. It didn't turn out to be a lasting victory.
Well, it was not a lasting victory, but for the moment, it could be portrayed as
for the moment, it was a real high. Yeah. And we come in a while, as we're running down the succession of presidents, to the second interaction with Iraq, the second invasion of Iraq, which didn't work out quite that simply or quite that quickly. We come, of course, next to here's an interesting issue. Let me take this up. I've got a minute and a half for it before we stop for a newscast. Why did, with that in his background, why did he lose the presidency to Bill Clinton?
Well, I think that there are a number of factors, but basically Bush was very high in the polls right after the Iraq War. And
up above 80%.
Yes, I mean, very high, and had a huge fall in the polls. There was an economic meltdown. There were serious problems domestically. He just plummeted in the polls, and Clinton had seized the opportunity, unlike a lot of Democrats who decided to sit that out because Bush seemed so popular a year before the election or a year and a half before. Clinton did jump in and benefited from that meltdown in Bush's own popularity.
And what he said, Debbie, that it's the economy, stupid.
Yes.
And that was the whole
that was their the slogan in the war room, yeah.
That was their slogan. I mean, they could – the Clinton people could – rest their entire case on a sagging economy, which has very contemporary overtones.
It may be relevant about a year from now.
Yes, indeed.
We shall see. Right now, what is immediately relevant is that we go to the WGN newsroom once again for a full update from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We're talking tonight with Marvin Kalb and Deborah Kalb, and drawing from their absolutely riveting new book, Haunting Legacy, Vietnam and the American Presidency from Ford to Obama. And since the book itself kind of runs sequentially through our presidential history, we're taking that form for this discussion tonight. So we are coming in just a moment to the successor to George Bush the First, namely to Bill Clinton. But before we do that, it is time to tell you that we will, of course, be working to the phone, working some phones and getting to them in a while, but probably not until after the 11:30 news break. So if you want to pose a question, you can defer for a while, or if you don't mind standing in line for a bit, you can even call right now. The number remains, as ever, 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. And for our listeners at some great distance, including those overseas, our internet listeners. If you want to pose a question via email, the email, of course, is already up and available. The address being extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com. And for calls, 312-591-7200. As we turn to Bill Clinton, he really, would you say, Deborah, just didn't want to get any boots on the ground ever, if he could avoid it?
That's correct. Bill Clinton, we spend a good bit of the chapter on Clinton talking about his well, he was the first baby boom president. He was the first president that had to face the choice of whether to go to Vietnam or not. And we spend a good bit of time talking about how he avoided going to Vietnam and avoided being in the military entirely. He had some guilt over that. And Vietnam was definitely on his mind, and he did not want to put boots on the ground. And that was something that he sought not to do throughout his presidency in various settings.
Well, what challenges did he confront with regard to potential military action?
Well, Somalia to begin with. George H.W. Bush sent troops in at the end of his term in office. And he assured Clinton that the American troops would be out of Somalia by the time you become president in January 20. Not true. The troops were there for at least another 9-10 months. There was Black Hawk Down, a terrible incident in which an American helicopter went down, shot down by a guy named Adid. And he was one of these warriors that the United States Army really has no business fighting because you can't beat these guys. But what they did was they shot down the helicopter, killed a lot of Americans. I think 21 Americans were killed there. And Bill Clinton was out campaigning, trying to raise money out in California. And he got the word on Black Hawk Down. And he turned to his aide immediately and said, "We're out." Now, he didn't say that to the American people. He said that to his aide. But in his mind immediately was, there's no winning here. There's nothing good politically here. There's nothing good for the United States.
So again, it's the Vietnam caution, is it?
And he did not in any way want to have a repeat of Vietnam. He didn't want us to get into Somalia, which reeked of not only corruption, but tribal warfare. There was no government there of any kind. There still isn't, by the way. So he didn't want. And that, by the way, there's a very good reason why he didn't. But Vietnam was in his mind all the time. He lived with, Debbie was talking about, he lived with guilt that he did not go and serve himself because friends of his from his hometown of Hope, Arkansas, were killed during the war. And he lived with that kind of guilt. His wife, Hillary Clinton, wrote a really wonderful book in which he said in the course of the book, Bill would have been delighted to fight in World War II because he approved of that war. But he did not approve of Vietnam, therefore didn't.
Well, in fact, in his personal history, there is some rather touchy stuff. Some have interpreted him to have been a draft dodger during.
Well, I think you could say that, absolutely. But what he did that is totally accurate is he did everything in his power to avoid service in Vietnam because he really didn't approve of the war and he didn't want to participate in it. So you asked about examples. Somalia was one. Then there was Bosnia, and then there was Kosovo. And we spend in this chapter a good bit of time on Kosovo because, again, Vietnam was all over the place. Everyone was saying to him, Mr. President, you do not have a lot of time in Kosovo. Either you get rid of Milosevic, the Serbian strongman at the time. You've got to get rid of the Serbian troops in Kosovo. The only way you're going to be able to do that is to put troops on the ground. He said, no. We'll bomb. So from 35,000 feet, Clinton was a great warrior. And he bombed in Kosovo. And
they also bombed the Serbian capital.
He did. Absolutely. And because for 78 days they bombed. And we were told by Sandy Berger, who was his national security advisor, that he and Bill Cohen, who was Secretary of Defense, had a private deal between the two of them. If on the 79th day we still do not have capitulation from Milosevic, we will have to tell the president we must put troops on the ground. Miraculously, early on the morning of the 79th day, Milosevic caved. And no one was happier than Bill Clinton because he knew at that point that he would not have to send troops in.
But later on, the American 1st Division was on the ground in Kosovo.
No, well, if they were on the ground, I don't believe so. Am I?
Beyond his administration, I guess.
Or do well, I have there was there were troops as part of a UN force that were in Bosnia and a very small UN force in Kosovo. But I, to the best of my knowledge, anyway, that was it.
David Grange, a retired general, came to run the Tribune Foundation in this building and was on this program now and again. He commanded the 1st Division and commanded it in the former Yugoslavia, whether it was in Kosovo or
I have a feeling it might, Milt, have been in Bosnia.
Maybe in Bosnia.
Bosnia, there was a definite American UN force.
Where you had a Muslim, Serbian mixed population.
That's right.
Yeah. So all in all, Clinton got away with very little.
Well, Clinton got away. What Clinton did was, living in this world of guilt, there was to be no as limited as possible troops on the ground. And so what he did was he was a brave guy at 35,000 feet, but he did accomplish what he wanted to do. And every now and then, an American president, you have to stand back and you say, hey, this guy didn't want to put troops in the ground, didn't have to.
At the same time, we had already become quite aware of al-Qaeda and had suffered some significant attacks from them, and we were out to get him. It happened far more recently than that. Is it true, because we had the story later on, that he had been, we've been surveilling the al-Qaeda people and bin Laden particularly, and had him located at a particular place where they were gathering. And the president was told we can get him if we go.
Absolutely.
And he decided not to.
No. What happened was that we shot a couple of missiles into that camp.
Yeah.
And we missed. Bin Laden had left about 20 minutes before the missiles arrived.
It was that close.
Because they were tipped off.
By whom?
And that was the thing. I don't know who tipped them off, but they were tipped off.
But he wasn't all that eager to go after bin Laden, was he?
Well, I think that, look, all the presidents are eager to go after bin Laden. One of them succeeded, namely Obama.
Yeah.
But it was extremely difficult to get him. Bush, too, had an opportunity in December of 2003 at Tora Bora, which is a town very close to Pakistan. We knew for a fact that bin Laden was there.
That, of course, was after 9/11.
That was after
9/11. We were activated in a
absolutely
new way.
And we knew where he was, and we had the opportunity to get him if we had committed American troops. The generals did not want to commit American troops again because of Vietnam. They were really very reluctant to put forces on the ground.
Well, but by then we had committed some troops, some special
there
forces.
There were 4,000.
And CIA types.
Absolutely.
In Afghanistan, to begin
absolutely.
With.
In Afghanistan, in Tora Bora, part of Afghanistan. We knew where bin Laden was, but we didn't want to use American troops.
No.
So what we did was we used Afghan troops, and they botched it. Now, I'm not saying that if we used Americans, they would have succeeded. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But we did not use the troops because we didn't want to get involved.
Next in line are some commercials. And then next in our line is George W. Bush and Barack Obama. And we'll be continuing in our quick analysis of presidents facing military challenges after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I know, but you know, Frank would be ready.
We are back on the air. We've been doing some private talk, which inevitably one would do. But we turn now directly to George W. Bush and his major foreign policy military commitments. And one can easily name them. They are the names of two countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. Were both of those necessary and inevitable, considering what the world presented to us?
Well, I think that you can separate the two of them out. I mean, when the Bush administration first came in, they had the idea of anything but Clinton. They wanted to do everything very differently from the way Clinton did. They did not, anything but Clinton. They did not want to just be doing everything with air power. They were fine with using boots on the ground.
And there was a new general doctrine. We are America, we're the most powerful nation in the world. Democracy is needed in the world. We're going to bring it to the world where possible.
And that was reinforced, of course, by September 11th.
Yeah.
And that changed everything in the world and changed the way the U.S. would be.
Does that doctrine have a name?
Which doctrine?
Does it name for anybody? Well, the aggressive stance in the larger world.
I don't think so. I think that Bush, too, believed in that. He believed that the United States, he was in effect saying, Vietnam be damned.
Yeah.
I mean, forget about Vietnam and all of the inhibiting forces.
We're still the big guys. And
we're the number one guys, and we're going to prove it. And if anybody hurts the United States, we're going to clobber them.
All right. It's obviously, we had to go into Afghanistan once the Afghanistan government refused hand up Osama bin Laden.
That's true.
We knew that bin Laden and al-Qaeda had done the 9/11 attack. But the larger question, of course, which will agitate historians for future years or generations, is did we have to go into Iraq?
Exactly. And that is so controversial. I mean, Afghanistan, which, of course, came up with President Obama's campaign in 2008, the war of choice versus the war of necessity, Afghanistan being the war of necessity, Iraq being the war of choice, and being a war that, in Obama's mind, was not necessary at all.
How was the decision to go into Iraq made? That's a White House story that needs close examination.
Well, that decision was something that was very, very much in the president's mind, but even more than that, it was in Rumsfeld's mind. It was in Wolfowitz's mind. Wolfowitz was Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy to Rumsfeld.
Product of the University of Chicago, by the way.
Right, really?
Sure.
Okay. Well,
trained by Albert Wolfstetter.
A number of these people were regarded as neocons. They believed that the world is a very dangerous place, that the U.S. was under attack, that the U.S. had to fight back. The U.S. had to use its troops. Moreover, they genuinely believed, and maybe they were right, that the United States was the most powerful country in the world, cannot be humiliated any longer. You can't go, as with Reagan, killing 241 Marines and getting away with it. You can't do that anymore.
Did Saddam Hussein's attempt to kill the senior George Bush have any bearing upon that decision?
Well, you got to be a psychiatrist there. And I don't know whether it did, but an awful lot of people say, yes, it did. But I think there was something else at play here. When 9/11 happened, Cheney told us in an interview, he said, you have to understand the world changed at that moment. If we were being attacked in a way similar to Pearl Harbor, 1941, December 7th, by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, if we were being attacked, we, the United States of America, simply cannot tolerate that. And we had to stop them. And that meant, in Cheney's mind, in Rumsfeld's mind, in Wolfowitz's mind, that we had to go into Iraq and get rid of Saddam Hussein. They believed, I think deeply, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and because of that, you had to go in and simply eliminate the threat. Your father, Mr. President, didn't do it, but you can. Now, that stuck.
Who was saying that?
This is the kind of thing that came up in all of their conversations.
But what particular persons are urging this upon him?
Oh, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and the vice president.
The same
now, the vice president, in his new book, talks about that moment very clearly.
But what are the chiefs of staff saying?
The chiefs of staff were very, very reluctant to get involved in a war in Iraq because a lot of these people were in power 10 years earlier with the first Bush. They were saying to the second Bush the
and
same thing they said to the first.
And they earned their early stripes or their early lieutenant's bars in Vietnam.
That is correct. Absolutely correct. And they were saying to him, Mr. President, if you want to go in there, we can do it, but that's not our recommendation. Why? Because, as in Vietnam, you never knew what you were going to find there. We did not know when we got rid of Saddam Hussein. That was never the issue, by the way. Militarily, it was never a question of whether we could get rid of him. That was assumed. And it was assumed that we could do that within a matter of weeks, and we did 3 weeks. But then what? Who do we put in power? How many troops are left behind? Under what conditions? For how long a period of time? It was Vietnam all over again.
Well, what happened in once we took Baghdad and we had a large military force, ultimately it was a force of over 500,000 men, I believe.
That's right.
Or 500,000 persons, a few women, to be sure. Why did Iraq turn out to be so messy and so difficult to bring to stability?
It was a very difficult situation. I mean, you had various factions within Iraq devolving into what was in effect becoming a civil war. You had U.S. troops facing constant explosive devices that they were running into. So the casualties were going up in Iraq. That was affecting the public mood about the situation there. So that was a political
concern. You're pointing essentially to the Sunni and Shia division.
Yes.
But also exacerbated, was it not, by Al-Qaeda intrusion?
By other groups as well. I mean, different groups in there. Yes, the Al-Qaeda and other foreign groups that were coming into Iraq. And so that resulted in George W. Bush putting the surge of additional troops in there, which stabilized it somewhat. So that was the impetus for him to do that, which is very controversial at the time.
What we're saying about George Bush right now and about Iraq naturally segues us into the last president on your list, the current president, Barack Obama.
Well,
he has just announced that we're pulling out completely by the end of the year. What will happen to Iraq?
Well, Iraq is going, we will pull our forces out of Iraq by the end of this year. And to pick up Debbie's point earlier, Obama said in 2002, before he was even a U.S. senator, a local fellow who made good, he said at that time that we have no business being in Iraq, that it was not a smart war. And during the 08 campaign, he said very clearly that Iraq was a war of choice, and we should not have made that choice. Afghanistan, however, he described as a war of necessity, and we have to win that war. He used that expression, we have to win in Afghanistan. Well, if you have to win in Afghanistan, if you're running for office, it's the easy thing to say. When you are president and you have to make these decisions, that's very difficult. And that's one of the things, by the way, we learned about all of these presidents. It's so easy as a reporter on the outside to criticize a president. But it's so hard for a reporter at the same time to imagine how difficult it is.
Well, now, what have you, in fact, learned about Barack Obama and his decisions in these realms, in the realms of war and foreign policy?
I would say, number one, as far as Afghanistan is concerned, Barack Obama believes that he cannot be the president as a Democrat without any military experience. He cannot be the president when Afghanistan collapses once again to the Taliban, for example. That is politically unacceptable, and he can't win an election that way or re-election that way. That is one of the big points. So in December last year in Lisbon at the NATO meeting, he decided to kick the can down the road because right now Obama's policy could be summed up as good enough. And what we mean by that, the last chapter is called Good Enough in this book. He doesn't know exactly how it's going to end. However, if it is good enough politically to be acceptable to the American people, then we'll end it. But if it is not good enough, he's going to stay in there as long as he's president.
But the way in which we're thinking of ending it, it's clear now, is to conciliate with and allow re-entry into power for the Taliban, maybe in coalition with President Hamid Karzai forces and so on, but to re-legitimate the Taliban, which once we condemned as absolutely anathema, we would never deal with it.
Right. Well, we'd never deal with the PLO and you do, and you'd never deal with the Viet Cong and you do. You're going to deal with the Taliban because they represent a legitimate, drop that word, they represent a real, practical military and political force in the country. And if you're going to have some kind of reconciliation, you have to do it with them. However, you talked before about Obama. The key thing with Obama, and it cannot be overlooked, Obama simply will not accept whatever could be interpreted as defeat. So he's going to do whatever is necessary to avoid anything that could be interpreted as an American defeat.
Of course, political commentators on television tonight will tell you what we do and achieve in Afghanistan or even in Iraq once we've left Iraq. Their fate and their future doesn't really matter that much with regard to American politics.
Well, it may
not. The ultimate issue in the coming presidential election will be our economy.
Well, it will be our economy. I don't think there's any doubt about that. However, if Afghanistan were to go down the tubes, and it was possible.
That would be bad for them.
That would be incredibly bad. Not only, by the way, not only for the Democrats and the Republicans, but bad for the country as well. What is it that you do? At the moment, I think we're simply floundering around. We don't have a clear policy.
Well, our listeners will explain to us what needs to be done.
God, I hope so.
When we turn to them, as we shall do, directly after an update on the news. But first, again, a strong invitation to all who are listening to call, to pose a question, or offer a thought. If you're offering a thought, try to express it succinctly and rather briefly, but we do certainly want to hear from you. 312-591-7200. The lines are now open. Some lines are taken. Some are still available. However, if you hit the busy signal when you call, don't be totally discouraged. Just try again right after we've said goodnight to a prior caller. So 312-591-7200 for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com, and to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And directly onto the phones for your questions and comments to Marvin Kalb and Deborah Kalb, who are the co-authors of the book now in hand, and a very important and utterly readable book it is, Haunting Legacy, Vietnam and the American Presidency from Ford to Obama. 591-7200, the number. 312, of course, is the area code. And for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. The first caller is Rich, who has reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening. You said earlier that Reagan did not respond militarily after the Lebanon barracks bombing. But later in his presidency, he did respond militarily after the Berlin nightclub bombing and sent a sortie into Libya. What was the difference between those two? Why did he respond in one and not in the other?
In one, there was a bombing in Berlin, and I believe there were one or two or three Americans who were killed. The difference of 241 to 203. That is a biblical question as to value here.
Yeah.
But one was an utter, total, humiliating attack on the United States in Beirut. What the president did at that time with respect to the Berlin bombing was bomb Libya. And he regarded Muammar Gaddafi as that madman from the Middle East. He didn't like him at all and sought an opportunity to attack, took full advantage of it, looked strong. But in Beirut, he looked, unfortunately, very weak.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the call. 312-591-7200, the number. One or two lines are available now. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try. Somebody will surely get through. And next up is Vicki. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes. When I'm calling about Vietnam, I had two sons in Vietnam, and one was in the Airborne, and the one was in the Screaming Eagles. Hmm. And my two nephews were also, and they all came back, thank God for that, because I felt so sorry for the mothers that only had one son. I had four in at one time. They all enlisted like their father did, because he was in World War II. To me, that was the big war. So I just had to tell you that because I'm looking at the Vietnam parade picture right now in my living room, and I was in that, and I was never so proud to be in that parade in all my life. The people were so nice to the veterans, and they ran up to them. They gave them pop if they wanted. They gave them sandwiches. I never saw anything like it, and it seemed like it was the best, biggest parade we had in Chicago on Michigan Avenue at that time, and we never have nothing like that anymore.
Are you talking about the end of the Vietnam War or the end of the first Persian Gulf War?
The Vietnam War. No. My two nephews and my two sons. And thank God they all came back alive.
Yeah.
And my husband was in World War II. He was in the Air Force down in the Pacific. But I'll tell you, I've never been so proud to have that picture in my living room. And it was a wonderful sight to see.
I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I don't know you, obviously, but I want to say that your story touches me because I feel very strongly now, and we try to say this in the last chapter of our book. If an American president sends American troops abroad, as your sons were sent abroad,
right.
They volunteered because they were, I don't know if they volunteered, but you're in the Vietnam War, you could be drafted.
Just like their father did. They all enlisted.
They all enlisted. Okay. In my opinion, if American forces are sent abroad any longer, it ought to be for a specific purpose to be explained to the American people so that they know exactly what the potential sacrifice is going to be.
Right.
You can't any longer, and again in my judgment, go into another war unless the American people offer complete support to the president.
Right. Because I'll tell you one thing. We're sending all our boys over there. I am 87 and a half years old, and
wow.
I see it. We're unprotected here, and they could come in the back door and really we could all be killed. That's the way I look at it, because we can't send any more boys over there. It's terrible.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call, and that's a very interesting contribution. That is a factor in or a force in American public opinion, which all presidents have to worry about and placate.
Well, and imagine if there were a draft today, Milt.
Yeah.
Imagine if there were a draft in campus at the University of Chicago, at Harvard, wherever. The campuses would be aflame at this particular point because of Afghanistan. Right now, less 0.6% of the American people are now fighting in defense of 99.4% of the American people. There's something hideously unfair about those numbers. And it seems to me that there has to be a better balance. I don't know whether it is that there ought to be universal service of some sort, military, economic, whatever. Because at this particular point, it is simply unfair for such a small percentage of the American people to be fighting for everybody else.
A general officer of my acquaintance, not the one I mentioned earlier, but somebody else now retired, once said to me, the way to handle that is make the generals lead the battles on the ground.
Yeah,
We go back to the phones. 312-591-7200. Rich has joined us. Good evening, sir.
Yes. I just wanted to quote real quickly from two cables from October 63 between Dean Rusk and McNamara, and I think it sets the whole stage for what happened later in Baghdad. And this is a result of a report from Roger Hilsman, Assistant Secretary of State, criticizing the political crisis of the Diem regime. And remember, this is October of 63, and the cables from Rusk, McNamara says, Dean, attached is the memo about the war in Vietnam. Below are the comments of the chiefs. If you were to tell me it's not the policy of the State Department to issue military appraisals without seeking the views of the Defense Department, the matter will die. Signed, Bob. 2 days later, Russ caved in and sent a cable. It's not the policy of the State Department to issue military appraisals. I have requested that any memoranda given interdepartmental circulation, which include military appraisals, be coordinated with your department. Cordially yours, Dean Rusk. You look back to the way Colin Powell was cut out of the loop on the run-up to Baghdad by Rumsfeld, by Cheney, and by Tenet, and you can just see it all over again.
Well, was he cut out of the loop, or didn't he essentially agree that we ought not to go further north to Baghdad?
Well, I think that my understanding is that he was very much in the loop, expressed his views twice, expressed them very forcefully to President Bush. Bush said that he respected Powell's views, but that the United States was going to proceed because the president strongly believed that with weapons of mass destruction, in his mind, they were already there in Iraq, they could pose a direct threat to the United States or to American allies, And under those circumstances, they had to be got rid of.
Oh, this is the question of whether he was in the loop during the second, with regard to decisions concerning.
Whether his intelligent assessments were actually fully included.
Yeah, but we're talking about the second Iran. We're talking about the second Iraq invasion rather than the first one run by the senior Bush.
Well, that's right. I think that we're talking about the second one. And in the second one, Powell was brought in. He expressed his views. I don't think it's fair to say he was cut out.
He went and fronted for us at the UN Security Council. Actually.
That's right, because he was the one most trusted. He had more credibility than anyone else in the government. And if you're going before the UN, you're going before the world, and you want to put your best foot forward. And that was Colin Powell.
A last round of commercials beckons. We take care of that and then directly back to the phones and to the email. But first, these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to the Kalbs. And I've got a longish, but I think quite interesting email I want to read to you. Both Kalbs assert that the U.S., quote, could not have won in Vietnam, in part because, quote, we did not know the Vietnamese. Plausible, if simplistic and lacking in any cogent analysis of what might have constituted sufficient knowledge. Flashback to the Philippines circa 1913. The U.S. defeated the Philippine insurrection. Southeast Asia, internal U.S. opposition to imperial and thus decidedly un-American in the eyes of many right-thinking Americans at the time, all of that in quotes, ambitions. The parallel may be imperfect, as are all historical parallels, but if, quote, knowledge is key to victory, what did the U.S., quote, know in the Philippines in the 19-teens that it did not know a half century later? Why apocalypse now, 1975, but not apocalypse then? And if not for two count'em U.S. victories in the 20th century in that distant archipelago, where might Francis Ford Coppola have filmed his Vietnam epic? Please discuss.
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting email, but let's face it, the United States and the Philippines engaged in brutal atrocities. It embarrasses me to have to say that, but it's a fact. The U.S., when it moved into the Philippines, engaged in one atrocious atrocity after another. As a matter of fact, the general who was in charge of these atrocities, I forgot his name right now, but something like Smith or Jones, was written about in newspaper articles, and there were books written about him because what we did, it was un-American. It was not the kind of thing that the United States ever should do. As a result of which, we were in occupation of the Philippines until 1945. We went there, according to President McKinley, to Christianize the heathen. That was the whole point of the operation. So this was not anything to be terribly proud of. Vietnam, when we speak about the ignorance of the American officers at that time, I remember something that my brother said, and my brother covered the war for a long time. He said, if you put a division of South Vietnamese troops, what they call the ROK Army, Republic of Korea, at the bottom, in the very south of South Vietnam, and told them that the PX was going to be open along the northern border, they would rush through everything to get to the northern border in order to, quote, occupy the PX, in order to buy everything in sight. We didn't give a hoot about the Vietnamese. We knew nothing about them. We looked down upon them, and it was really a disgrace.
And we will go directly on to the phones in just a moment. I must tell you, while the Vietnam War was still on, I had occasion to give some lectures at, of all places, the Ateneo de Manila, a women's college in Manila. I was talking about contemporary matters and about contemporary foreign policy challenges to the United States. And here were these bright young, sort of upper class, I think, in the main, Philippine young women in the audience. And they surrounded me after it, full of stories about American Atrocity. It was amazing that they, in the original suppression, they got it from their grandfathers or their great-grandfathers or whatever histories had been written and which still focused on that. It remained a source of deep annoyance, deep rage, deep resentment so many years later.
Well, it does, and I think for very good reason. However, we did at the same time do a lot of very good things in the Philippines. And the Philippines economy was raised significantly over that 40-year period. But you can't erase history. You can't erase what we did in the Philippines, and you cannot erase a defeat in Vietnam.
Can you erase the resentment against us presently in Iraq proper?
Well, I think it's not just in Iraq. It's in large areas of the globe that there's a lot of resentment against the United States.
But we've killed people, and we've presided over the killing of people in Iraq and Afghanistan particularly.
Exactly. No, I think it would take a long time to get over that. I think it really depends on how events unfold in the next period of time. With the U.S. pulling out of Iraq, it'll be interesting to see how there's going to be a huge diplomatic presence by the United States in that country, and that will be a challenge for them to try to create a better image of the country in there by diplomatic efforts.
We go back to the phones, time being short. Next up is Gary. You are on the air, sir.
Yes, I don't understand why we can't pull out of Afghanistan. I mean, I don't know what would hold us there. I'm a supporter of the president, and I wouldn't hold it against him if we pulled out. I mean, the British Empire couldn't control Afghanistan. Russia failed to control Afghanistan. I don't know why we should bother.
Well, I think there's really one remaining fundamental reason that the president is coping with but doesn't talk about. There are about 120 nuclear weapons in the northern part of Pakistan, right nearby. Those weapons are protected by the Pakistani army, we are told. The Pakistani army is corrupt, riven with dissension, unreliable, and yet they are the force protecting the weapons, and the United States is assured that those weapons are being protected. Vice President Biden said when the whole debate took place in the summer of 2009, what we're supposed to do in Afghanistan, he said that he would be happy if there were a force of 25,000 Americans in the southern part of Afghanistan, there primarily just to observe what is happening with the nuclear weapons, and that if we had evidence or intelligence that there was a danger that those weapons could fall into the hands of the bad guys, that we had the military force there to stop that. Now, can you argue that the 25,000... Did you need 25,000? Couldn't you do that with 5,000? The argument there is numbers. But as a policy matter, do you place American forces in Afghanistan in the long term, over a long period of time, to look after the hugely unreliable, unstable arrangement in Pakistan? That is the policy issue. And it isn't simply a matter of just pulling out. Pulling out, in a way, is easy. It's pulling out, and then what happens? And Obama cannot tolerate the idea that it would be a loss that he would be saddled with as a Democrat with little military experience losing a war. He has, whether you like it or not, or whether you agree or not, that's in his mind.
Our thanks to the caller. We must move very quickly. But even before we do, it's time for me to say a few things related to our website, or rather to the podcast you find on our website. Tonight's program will be available there by tomorrow afternoon. If you want to hear it again, or if you want to direct friends to it who may not have heard it tonight, all they've got to do, all you've got to do, is go to the website, the address being wgnradio.com/extension720. And there you'll find all the programs of the recent week or two, and for that matter, all the programs if you go on to adjoining pages when you're invited to click on many more podcasts. You'll find everything that you might be looking for over recent months or even years. We've also got up many classic Extension 720 programs, which I think you will find of great interest. One we've just put up, though it's quite an old one, is titled High Lonesome. I read the description. Author Celia Teachy joins Milt to discuss the history of country music and its ability to reflect traditional American concerns. That program goes back way back to 1994. Classic conversations with Carl Sagan, with Henry Kissinger, with the former, the original Senator McCarthy, the good McCarthy, so to speak, and, for that matter, discussions of the search for the historical Jesus. A conversation with James McPherson, the great historian of the Civil War, and on along those lines. 312-591-7200 is our number, but I don't really know why I tell you that, because there isn't time for any more phone calls at the moment, rather in the 2 minutes remaining. What did you come out with from the doing of this book that illuminated something you didn't understand before? Or what conviction did you draw from the work?
Well, I think that one really important thing is just the huge differences in how each president approached the legacy of Vietnam. I mean, you have some presidents who wanted to sort of battle back against that legacy by being as tough as possible, and others who took a far more cautious approach. And of course, some presidents who did a little of each. So I was just fascinated by the decision making that each of these presidents used.
But on the basis of that, what advice, if any, would you give to future presidents?
Know the country you're getting involved in. And have respect for that country as an enemy, if that's what you choose to think of it as. Don't allow the United States ever again, as we did in Vietnam, to get involved in a country that we don't understand for reasons that are not clear to us. And the wasting, that's a terrible wasting of American life. That, to me, is what I picked up from this book.
Well, thanks so much to both of you for joining us tonight. Our guests have been Marvin Kalb and Deborah Kalb, father and daughter, and together the authors of the new book, Haunting Legacy, Vietnam and the American Presidency, From Ford to Obama, vividly written, extremely informative, very intelligent, in fact, if one can compliment a book for simply being very intelligent, and available wherever they sell real books. Tomorrow night, we return to the sort of general news review with a strong focus, I guess, on American politics, inevitably. My guest, Joe Morris, former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, Richard Ciccone, former Managing Editor of the Chicago Tribune, and at least one other guest still to be determined. That's tomorrow at 10. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.